der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Hello everybody. Again, it's time for the Hurra Hurra Podcast. Today it's the already 11th episode and I'm very happy to have James Auger here. Not here, but like you have it here, but it's not here for me because he is in Paris and I'm in Dresden. And I'm very happy because I always tell a story in the beginning of the podcast why the guest I choose is related to the Hurra Hurra Festival on Design Education that we held last year. And while we've been preparing all the bookings and curation of all the people that we want to have at the festival, the speculative EDU network came just like across every portable and desktop screen that we had. And we tried to invite all the people from there because we think that speculative design is a very important way of thinking and doing design in the 21st century. And we reached out to Ivica Mitrovic and he said that he can't come because they have right in the same time an event in Rome or somewhere in southern Europe. And then everything went a bit off the screen because everything became quite busy. And again, I reached out and asked Ivica who could be a good person to talk to about the whole speculative EDU network. And he pointed out to James Auger, and I'm very happy to have James Auger here because I admire his work since a long time. And yeah, before I go more into depth on what we're going to talk about Newton machine speculative design and reconstraint design, I want to ask James to introduce himself. Hello, James.
Hello. Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and also thanks to Ivica for proposing me for this. It's a privilege to spread the word of speculative design, I guess, on behalf of Speculative Edu. To introduce myself, hard to know where to start. I suppose the easiest thing is with the start of my experience with speculative design, which came at the Royal College of Art, not 20 years ago now, in fact. Seems hard to believe. I was on a master program called Design Products with Ron Arad as the professor, the well-known furniture designer, architect. And I fell under the tutelage, I can't find the word there, of Anthony Dunn and Durrell Bishop. Anthony Dunn, obviously well-known for critical design. And also during this period, I met Jimmy Loiseau, who I've been collaborating with for the most part of the last 20 years. And this was essentially where we found speculative design. It wasn't called speculative design at the time. It was just a form of design that was much more about interrogating things, questioning the way the world is, not just putting more things in the world, which had been, I guess, the approach of my bachelor degree from the Glasgow School of Art, but really starting to wonder what the role of design is. And it transformed my idea. I'd gone to the Royal College of Art expecting to do furniture design. I was going to buy a farm in the countryside and build furniture. That was my big plan prior to starting the RCA. And I think within 2 weeks, my brain had been blown wide open. I had a total transformation of what design could be. And figured that out over the next 2 years, partially with Jimmy, partially with Anthony Dunn and Durrell Bishop. I'll cut the long story short. We graduated from the RCA almost immediately. 6 month break, took a job in Media Lab Europe, which was the MIT Media Lab's European partner, together with Jimmy, and it just allowed us to continue this form of design, shifting more into the research context just because of the nature of the job, building on the approach, learning more about it, figuring out why we do it, what the purpose is, exhibiting more, talking more at conferences. That was about 3 years in Dublin working for MLE, Media Lab Europe. And then that led to an opening at the Royal College of Art. Anthony Dunn became professor of a program that became known a couple of years later as Design Interactions. And there was a call for people to teach on the program. And I applied for it. I had a brief trip over to London. I'd been spending the summer in France with my wife. We had a small child during that summer period. And That led to a job at the Royal College of Art, where I spent the next 10 years working on the design interaction program, which really started to, I guess, formulate the discipline or the approach of speculative design, building on the origins of critical design. I did a PhD during this period, which I guess deepened my knowledge of the subject. I became much more comfortable theoretically, which I guess is the key benefit of doing a PhD. Moved to Madeira in 2015, where I spent 3 years at an institute that was at the time called MITI, Madeira Interactive Technologies Institute. And then around 18 months ago, I moved to Paris, where I'm currently based, teaching and co-directing a program at the École Normale Supérieure. So it's a design research master degree with the possibility to go on to do a PhD. Through practice is important to mention the practical aspect, because this is, I think, quite rare in design that we can really push the practice element. With that, I've been working with RMIT, the Australian University, since around 2015, because they have amazing expertise in what a practice-based PhD is. So they've been looking at that field for about 25 years. And so we're building a relationship with them as a way of evaluating and awarding the PhD from France. So that's a nutshell.
What a nutshell.
Whirlwind tour of the last 20 years. I probably missed a few things there.
That is very interesting. And before we go really deep into the topic, I really would like to know, because you mentioned it in the very first sentences of your nutshell talk right now, that you came to the RCA with that idea of becoming a designer, and then within 2 weeks your brain blew away. How did that happen? How can a university do that to you?
The wonderful thing about the Royal College of Art 20 years ago was a culture. It was a culture like nothing I'd experienced before. Not just the teachers. Ron Arad was excellent at bringing in a huge breadth of knowledge. People from many different disciplines coming together at this time. Very, very well-known practitioners. People on the more experimental end of design. And it was what was called a platform system. There are 8 platforms, each focusing on a slightly different form of design. And as I said, my plan had been to choose one of the more furniture-focused platforms. But I met Jimmy probably in the first week. He was the year above me, so he was already on the platform of Tony and Durrell. And I had another friend, a guy called Chris Downs, who was in computer-related design. And he'd been the one. He said, you need to talk to Jimmy and you need to talk to Tony and Durrell. And there was another character, filmmaker, artist, stroke designer. He's not so much of a designer anymore. Noam Turan, who was in my year, who I got to know very, very early on. It was a fire alarm, and we bumped into each other in the first week outside the Royal Albert Hall. And both were just discussing how in awe we were of the place, how terrified we were of the whole system, all of these people around us who just seemed so incredibly talented. And I guess we found our way together. We had a discussion, and suddenly the way Tony and Durrell had presented the platform just seemed a lot more interesting for me than the furniture platforms. I'd spent the last 5 years prior to the RCA in special effects and model making for film and television. So I'd been in a workshop for literally 5 years making stuff, which gave me, I suppose, a good ability in the workshop. I could make many things across a range of techniques and tools, materials, whether it's metal, machining, casting, sculpting. And the thought I had was that applied to furniture would be interesting, because I could really push the approaches, the methods that we make furniture. But then suddenly this intellectual, more, I suppose, interrogatory, I don't know if that's a word, a way of interrogating the world around us, rather than just adding to it and putting more things in there, just questioning if the world as it is at the moment is the right one, challenging the way we use technology and so on. It was just much more inquisitive, and I I latched onto that somehow. And I think it took me 8 months to become comfortable with what it was all about. I was having sleepless nights. It was very stressful, but suddenly it all came together, probably April, March, at the end of the first year, as I found my place, I guess. And I started building more things, getting in the workshop, but the things that I was building were things from the depths of my imagination. I wasn't building the things that had been given to me by an art director working on a film or on an advertising campaign. And there was a different purpose for these things. They weren't just to sell dubious products, but they were really just starting to understand the role of technology, understanding better the systems through which industrial design happens, and just starting to question the whole world around us, which is kind of rare in design, I think. Certainly from my previous, my bachelor education, which was much more a normative product design approach.
In the CV or biography on Ogalozo, you call it, give a design a different agenda, or is it called agenda? Investigating the process that gives birth to rather than being or defined by it. I really like the idea of a different, what is it, agenda?
Agenda.
I learn a lot
it's
of
the
things.
The soft
agenda. And that different agenda is really interesting to me because it comes with a more focus on non-physical outputs and with design outputs. I would not call them objects, but I like the fact that they get a physical expression. And and that's what the whole speculative design thing is about. And then you started the speculative edu project, and you say it's about to strengthen the speculative design education. Is it because you want to change that agenda in design education towards that less commercial aspect?
I suppose the step away from the commercial world is... it's essential if we want design to be more responsible. You know, I look back on my bachelor's education, and I think it placed me, I was reasonably well placed to design products at the end of that 4-year period. But there was nothing in it that suggested that these products could be problematic. It's something that I wrote about with my colleague from Madeira, Julian Hanna, who I spent many years, mostly in Madeira, working with Julian. We wrote a blog together and founded a group. This is where the reconstrained design came from. And really, at the beginning, we started questioning the role of progress. Many people have been questioning the role of progress for many, many years, going back centuries or more. But it's just something that had really not happened in design. My own education, as I said, at the bachelor level was very much that design is great. Design improves people's lives. Design improves our comfort. Design solves problems. And it was this very idealistic, optimistic discipline that just is, you can hold your head high because you're the good guy. I believed that for quite a long time. It was quite powerfully beaten into us that you're doing good things. And I suppose it was several years later on, partially through the teaching at the RCA, the masters, but then reading much deeper from different disciplines like science and technology studies and philosophy of technology, certainly myself maturing and examining better or even questioning my own use of tools and techniques and products and so on. I mean, it's wherever I don't know exactly how old you are, but I remember very well my life before the internet, before mobile telephones existed, and such a rapid transformation of the way we interact, the way our life is mediated through technology. I started to become, I guess, a little bit more cynical about these things. I think there's there's the rate of change is far too fast. There's very little opportunity to discuss these technologies before they arrive in the marketplace, before they transform people's lives. And yeah, by the time we realize there are implications, it's too late, because we're all reliant upon these things, you know. And I think that for me was the point that came out of the RCA, was fundamentally the need to question the role of design, the way we educate design, because it's still largely locked in its industrial design past from the 1930s, the styling, the shaping of interaction, the packaging of a technology so it becomes desirable. You know, it's really not moved on hardly at all, whilst the world that we're living in has changed absolutely enormously. And I think speculative design started to understand that. It was a bit naive in the beginning. We were certainly very, very naive in the way we were developing projects, but we felt that there was something interesting happening. And coming back to the Erasmus-funded project, Speculative Edu, it seems like an excellent time to start reflecting on the speculative design that's happened in the past 20 years, to start understanding better the methods, because they're quite broad, to start understanding the metrics, how we can evaluate speculative design, because we're starting to become a little bit more critical of our expectations, or not expectations of the role of speculative designed artifacts or the projects that take place. Because for many years, we were very, very happy that pieces would end up in a gallery somewhere. This was very, very nice in 2005 to be traveling around the world showing our work in galleries. But I think we hit a bit of a wave of critique in 2012. There was a Museum of Modern Art curatorial experiment called Design and Violence, and a big discussion took place about the work happening at the RCA. It was the first time in 7 years we'd come under sustained critique. And
That would be really interesting, even for me. Tell me a bit more about the exhibition and the critique that
it
came
was,
up with it.
I would say a lack of political engagement, perhaps, a naivety. And I'm speaking, I won't talk about anybody else's projects. So I won't talk about our student projects. I can talk very personally about the projects that I'd been doing with Jimmy up until that point. I think certainly from my point of view, being very self-critical, I was still very naive about the history of design, the politics of design, the role of the economy, it was doing the PhD, I suppose, that suddenly revealed the complexity of the world that as it relates to design. And so suddenly discovering science and technology studies, which I knew hardly anything about during the master degree, suddenly I realized there's a whole body of work that's very, very related. There's so many complementary interests and knowledge bases that it seems crazy that these two didn't combine in some way. Working much more closely with anthropologists, with philosophers, and my colleague Ernest is a philosopher of technology. It's just there was a richness of knowledge that was so complementary for speculative design that I think I'd been missing, and certainly the way I'd been teaching my students at the RCA, there was a lot of information I suppose I hadn't been passing on. And this critique in 2012 reflected a lot of that. Is it's okay to critique the role of technology, but you know, you can do that very naively through, I suppose, provocative, beautifully executed designed artifacts that look sensational, that look fantastic in a gallery, but what purpose do they have beyond the gallery? And I think as I came to the end of my time at the Royal College of Art, I moved to Madeira. I arrived in Madeira, I think, September 2015, there was an open office. On my first day, they showed me into the office, and that was it. You know, I didn't walk into an existing project. Mm-hmm. There was nothing to do. It was just really almost starting from the beginning. And this just became a wonderful time to reflect on the past 10 years through many, many discussions with my new colleague, Julian Hanna, whose expertise is on manifesto writing and modernism. It was just a different kind of intellectual expertise. Together, the dialogue we had was an amazing foundation to this new period in Madeira. So we wrote an awful amount. We started a blog together, and then that led to the new project.
That is very interesting, because I wasn't really aware that there was this kind of let's say critical moment in critical design to that time of 2012. But I really like the idea that it led to that point of reevaluating what speculative design can be, because as a young person, and I'm not that young anymore, but as I've been like tumbling into the idea of non-industrial design, let's call it like this, because it uses a lot of techniques that come from the industrial design practice, but produce end results that are definitely not industrial design objects and products. I was super happy to be able to do that, and to do that with a design attitude and not being an artist. And since I dived more deeper in that, and I'm following you there, I was getting a bit more weird that everything ends up in a gallery. And I found that that idea, I don't know where the quote is from, but bringing the critical ideas into the supermarket shelves and not into the galleries is a democratizing, making the idea more accessible to a broader, not audience, but user group. And having the thing standing there is already a political statement to give it to everybody, and not closing it into white walls. And that, for me, it was always a political thing. I was a bit, I found I don't know where I saw it the first time, the Dan and Raby things with the table with the compasses and the doll with the penis. And I didn't find that very critical. I found that more or less a cynical or joyful approach of doing things, but and labeling it design. But still, it was in a discourse like that was very interested and was held from designers that have been industrial designers. They were looking at it and found it very interesting, like the generation above me or elder than me. And that's very interesting. And would you say that, like, from now on, that, because you say that industrial design, you always put the industrial design also in like brackets, that it's something, it's design, and then there's this brackets industrial in front. And do we leave the industrial thing totally? Is that something that that we move away from the industrial coining of the design heritage and move on to more or less speculative or research driven design?
It depends on the state of the world has got much to do with this, because, you know, on the one hand you have designers who continue to put new things in the world, and then alongside that you have the economy, which is still very much driven by new things being put in the world, and then related to that you have consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, and these are the three key factors that are almost immovable at the moment. It's very, very hard to imagine, certainly prior to the coronavirus, it's very, very hard to imagine these things moving. If we look at Apple, for example, probably the most powerful or the biggest company in the world, whose wealth, whose power has been built on the notion of good design. And if we look at consumer behavior around Apple products, the fanfare every time Apple produced new products, the queues around the city block of people waiting overnight to get the latest iPhone, you know, these are for me fundamental things that need to change, but are almost the most impossible things to understand how they might change. We often cite Adam Curtis's Century of the Self, a documentary about how the rise of marketing and public relations in the 20th century led to this particular system through the work of Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew, who really started to tap into the human psyche. And there's a quote from Paul Mazur, who was a banker at Lehman Brothers, who talks about shifting America from a country of needs to a country of desires. And the documentary goes on to explain exactly how that process happened and how successful these people have been in really tapping into what we see as being desirable. And so these were some of the questions that Julian, and Julian, as I said, is an expert in manifestos. We wrote our own small manifesto in Madeira, and it was based on quotations that we found. We found about 12 quotations that we found interesting, and each one had a demand or an act. And one of them was to take Paul Mazur's statement and reverse it. So if we can shift back to needs rather than desires, or we can satisfy desires in more suitable ways through the same techniques. You know, if these marketing public relations techniques can create a civilization of desire, then perhaps the same techniques can change what is desirable. And I think this is the fundamental shift that needs to happen in industrial design. You can see some very, very early steps with things like the Fairphone, where you have a very different system, and a lot of the maker spaces, the new fixing agenda. You know, if companies start to build things that can be fixed, I think there'll be a migration towards those kind of products. And particularly as the younger generation, we see a lot of younger people getting much more engaged in issues of sustainability and the state of the world. And I think all it takes is for that generation to suddenly see Apple as being very uncool, because of where its materials come from, where its products are made, the generational aspect of them. And this is when we potentially see the fundamental shift in industrial design. And this is, for me, one of the more interesting things to speculate on, is what fills that gap? Or what is the next version of, let's say it's non-industrial design? Well, what does it mean to do non-industrial design? Where do the materials come from? What are the making skills? What are the making machines? Who does it? Where's the knowledge base? Mm-hmm. And how can all of those things be more aligned with the problems that we're facing today? So rather than, as I said, the Industrial Revolution, the times of streamlined modern in the 1930s, seeing the world as an open resource where we can just be taking our elements from absolutely anywhere, it's not a problem because they're unlimited, to being a design community that really thinks thoughtfully about where our elements come from, you know, not pillaging the ground in remote countries, not continuing this colonial attitude of taking what we need when we need it and putting it into products that have a 1-year lifespan. To really start to explore what that alternative could be is, for me, very exciting.
You call that a reconstraint design. Is that a branch? Would you say that is a branch of speculative design, or is it something that moves on from speculating a future that might be to a future that should be?
Yeah, it's an important question for us. I mean, I felt very guilty putting another design term into this already very, very heavily bloated design lexicon. But I was getting frustrated with the term speculative design. It was coming to mean different things to different people. And it was, again, this is something that happened in the early period in Madeira. I was reflecting on, for me, what are the key strengths of speculative design? The key strength being that if we're not putting products into the marketplace for profit, then there becomes suddenly a lot of freedom. Freedom to imagine a different version of design, freedom to imagine a different attitude towards technology, freedom to question the role of design and technology, rather than just using it to make some profit. And it was then that focus on the constraints that seemed really interesting for me. And that was really the early work that Julian and myself put together, some essays, you'll find them on our blog called Crep Futures, starting to identify the constraints that limit the potential of design as it is at the moment. Once we understand those constraints, this is a research process, we can understand how they act, who's in control of them. But then we can also start to think about what happens if we reconstrain. It's not unconstrain, because mm-hmm. that's without rules. It's reconstrain, it's understanding the system, but then starting to find better ways of realizing products. So, for example, we started with the constraint of progress dogma, the belief that technology and designed artifacts lead to a better life. As soon as you remove that constraint, you can think about a form of design where you can experiment. This is where the speculative design origins come in, but you can think about near future products. Imagine what that world could be like if those products existed, and have a really serious debate with experts from various fields about what life would be like with that product. So the very first project Jimmy and myself did together, the audio tooth implant, is a really good example of that. Touches on your point about the gallery there and trying to be more ambitious and more democratic. We really explored the use of media as the gallery space. So we're in newspapers mm-hmm. across the world. We're on radio programs. We really got a great discussion going about that particular product. We've got a letter from an associate professor of medicine at Stanford, 4-page letter describing how bad this product would be should it arrive on the marketplace. But this is the product here, is the discourse, and we can learn from this discourse, and then we can perhaps modify the product or even make them illegal if they're mm-hmm. potentially so dangerous. You know, and if we start to think about the Internet of Things and the rise of artificial intelligence being put into everyday products, these things are not straightforward. You know, if you look at the role of something like Amazon's Echo, it's a very, very loaded product. To me, it's essentially a Trojan horse bringing the eye of Amazon into your very private lives in your house. You know, there needs to be a debate about this kind of technology. We don't just assume it's going to make things better. So that's the first one. Progress dogma is really starting to think that for every technology that we put out there, there are implications as well as applications, problems as well as benefits. And we just wrote a few essays on this. We've outlined 6 or 7 key constraints that we think limit the potential of design as it exists in the marketplace at the moment. And then we give project examples of what the reconstrained version would look like. And for me, it's a much more pragmatic approach than speculative design. It's really talking about the design experience. You know, when you design something, constraints are really at the heart of every design project. But typically, we think about the material constraints. How much can you bend a piece of plywood? We might think about the cost constraints of bringing something to market. Time constraints. Can you deliver it to the deadline? Very practical constraints. But, you know, there are these much, much grander, these pervasive, ubiquitous, but hidden, typically hidden constraints that we design for without even thinking about. And when we reveal them, things become really interesting.
But in the end, it's basically the same thing as I learned it in the industrial design department, because it's taking all the constraints in account, but redefining the constraints before. And that is super interesting, because my question was like, how do you do that with students? How do you, let's not call it teaching, but how you develop that sort of thinking with the young folks, with the people that are like you have been when you entered the RCA? So I mean, I'm very much interested in the methodology of that. How you get this idea to the people?
Just like any other design situation, really, is through the brief. We spend a lot of time writing briefs. The key thing for me is design education, when you're in your education, is in many ways the best time to be a designer. There is a freedom. And I just push the students as much as I can to use this time to really to dream, to use their imagination as much as they possibly can. And we try and facilitate that and push that through the briefs that we write. There are very straightforward briefs, and there are briefs that really start to exploit techniques that come from design fiction. Design fiction, speculative design, very closely related, but I think design fiction has a slightly clearer way of talking about a story world, and we design for that story world. So typically in the briefs that we write, we imagine a world slightly different from the one that we're living in at the moment. Design typically, we design for the world as it is. Okay. If this world was slightly different, what would the products look like? And so we use techniques like counterfactual histories. There's a brief that we ran on energy that imagines that Nikola Tesla never existed. And so without Nikola Tesla, you have no alternating current, and you have no power stations in the countryside, and the long distance transmission of energy that basically gives our energy systems as they exist at the moment. So you could then look at the time of Tesla, look at the patents from that era, look at the alternative energy systems that were being imagined, and imagine a history to this day that's gone down a different pathway, because those choices that we made in the distant past influence how things are today. So if different choices had been made, the world would look very, very different. And this is a really fascinating approach at really starting to interrogate the bigger systems that define how the world is at this moment in time. So these briefs are fairly research intensive. You can look at the key points along that technological trajectory. You can imagine influence that did happen, events that did happen that would have maybe changed the direction of things. And it just creates a very, very rich landscape, alternative landscape for developing alternative products or systems. That's just one example. But ideally, the briefs encourage the students, almost without realizing it, to be learning and understanding better the systems that facilitate both the function of the products we use, the manufacture of the products that we use, the cultural systems that dictate our behavior as we interact or use these kind of products. So it's trying to immerse them in a much richer and complex ecology, you could say. So that's not just a reduction of simplicity, which I think a lot of design suffers from. There's very much a focus on the product, the scale of the product, and our interactions on that scale, and to the neglect of the much bigger systems that essentially define and constrain everything.
And I think that
And
is a
so
good
that, for me,
point.
is the design education, the importance.
Not narrowing down the scope. That is super interesting because, and I think that is something that comes with the idea of not having a product in the end. Like a product is like a condensation or condensate of idea and thinking. It crystallizes in that one thing. Every thinking is at an end. And there, like talking about fictions and narrations and worlds. I really like the idea of worlds because they do not have that linearity of time. That is that is something that helps me right now to understand how we can go beyond what has been called industrial design, because that leaving the idea of not training, or leaving the idea of training people to become like helpers of a system of desire, then and moving it towards to just like helping people in needs without the aim of being the persons who solve problems is very interesting, and I think it's also very difficult, because it's very difficult. It takes us in a very critical position to ourselves and our own history of education, because everything we learned has to be overcome. And that no, it's true. It's like, it's something that's not super easy for me, because it's like, problem solving. Of course we solve problems. And no, sir, it's over. And with every problem we solve, we just like create millions of other problems. And being aware of that and being humble in a way of your own position, because like the idea of being that super famous designer, I think it's also in your Reconstraint manifesto about the Philip Starck Juicy Salif. Yeah, it's not about to be used, it's about to start conversation. And which I found very interesting, because you coined it as that superstar, in Germany we say Autoren designer, like authorship designers, and you just like turned it into the dark niche. But that's what speculative design does as well, like having a thing standing there. And it's not about, that machine is not about to eat flies on the wall, but it's about to start conversation about what is a machine to be that is able to eat flies. And I think that we are not so super far away. And that what I mean is being critical with ourselves. Can you follow me on that point?
Yes, very well. Yeah.
Looking at the speculative Edo network, can you say that there is some large scene in Europe that is moving to that direction of reshaping the industrial design, let's say, education scene towards that new scene? And is that a scene that shares the same ground in a way? Or is it super heterogeneous, different, differing?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know enough about the design scene across the entirety of Europe. There's been a lot of interest in speculative edu. It's the events that we've been running. There's been a variety of different events, from workshops to conferences. And these have been picking up a pretty decent following. I think the website's been pretty successful. We've been running a number of interviews with people who've been doing speculative design or curating speculative design for a number of years, and I think we're starting to develop kind of an interesting repository there. So
definitely,
this has been great. The thing that we really wanted to do, because the whole approach is still moving, there's not a really clearly defined explanation, a definition of speculative design is really not existing as far as I can tell. And along with that, I said it earlier, but we don't really have the metric system. So, when we talk about industrial design, it's very, very clear what is a good chair. We have the language for that. We have the vocabulary. Dieter Rams has got his list of 10 criteria for good design.
It's
very well known. I don't know. German, I think. The speculative design, because it's quite new, doesn't really have that. And that's one of the things we wanted to contribute, was to really start to understand better, what are our expectations? And really, from the beginning, it was very clear, is going beyond the gallery, just having a show in the Museum of Modern Art is not enough. Is how can we start to become more politically engaged or active? What are the routes through which that can happen? And I think the more interesting projects at the moment are are engaging with politicians or working much more closely with scientific research. So the laboratories where technology is emerging, design can start to play a part in potentially shaping or adjusting that technological trajectory. So there are different things starting to happen. And yeah, that's one of the key questions that we're asking of the interviews, is for each person to name what they see as being an exceptional speculative design project. At the end of all of this, we're going to publish a book about the experience. And hopefully this will be helpful for any schools that are interested in running speculative design courses. I think that's the key point. There isn't much literature out there. There's very, very little help in how do you teach this stuff. You know, I think schools, I was external examiner at a design school a few years ago, I won't say which one, but suddenly they realized speculative design was popular. They had it on the curriculum, but there was no one there with the experience or knowledge of how to teach it. So it was done, I would say, not very well. You know, so I think this is, for me, the key aim, or one of the great purposes of the Speculative Edu project, is just to put forth some more resources, somewhere where we can find expertise and guidance, that if somebody does want to run a speculative design course, there's just something that they can lean on, to fall back on, to help guide them a little bit.
Did you just crawl through your existing network, or was there just like people coming off on the screen that you never have heard of before?
We were it was very clear and important for us that we go beyond the old RCA network, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's what, 5 years since Design Interactions came to an end, but it still has a legacy. You know, it's still, particularly the work of Anthony and Fiona is still heavily cited as the core of speculative design. So we were very, very keen to go beyond that. Of course, there are people from the program. Anthony and Fiona were a part of the interviews. A bunch of our graduates who've gone on to find a career in speculative design have been interviewed. But then very, very strong critiques of speculative design, people like Cameron Tonkin Wise are on there, mm-hmm. as well. And then people who are coming from very, very different domains. We wanted to go outside Europe, so there are a couple of people from the US on there proposing, you know, their own take on speculative design. So it's as international as we could be, and also as diverse. You know, we're very happy, in fact delighted, for me, to take on critique, because it's that critique that you learn from. And through that, we improve the practice and the methods, the approach. And so, we've embraced any of the critique that comes our way. That's, again, very much part of the dialogues that we were having, is a rich discourse of critique, response, feedback, ideas, all coming together in this one place.
Did somebody came up with a, no, not say solution, but that come up with a direction on how to handle or to reach more political impact through the way of speculative and critical designing, like in your observations, like and we've been talking about this before, that it stays in the galleries and it says it's been critical, but it doesn't comes with the impact. Is there some sort of guiding help to gain impact through the way of narrative design, fictional design, speculative artifacts?
Yeah, it's starting slowly to become a bit easier. There's a project that I did with a colleague of mine in Madeira, Enrique Encinas. We were commissioned by some friends, Alex and Suzanne, at the European Commission. And they've been using speculative design techniques to engage with policymakers there. So we were over there in Brussels for a three-day workshop on blockchain. Mm-hmm. And we ran a group looking at blockchain and intellectual property, and developed through speculative design an artifact, an interactive installation that was then used within the commission to initiate discussions with the policymakers who would be implementing that policy on blockchain. And this for us was a great breakthrough. And Alex and Suzanne have been really pushing that agenda. They've been looking at alternative governments through speculative design. I think there's an AI program as well. So they've got they're deeply embedded in the political center of Europe. And so there are small approaches like that starting. A grad from ours from the RCA, Tobias Ravel, has been engaging a little bit with the UK government a few years ago. It was a bit easier in Madeira because we had access, because of the size of the island, we could get access to policymakers really easily. Because of the stature of the lab on the island, we'd have open nights, and quite often the politicians would arrive. And so we could expose them to the ideas that we were developing. The scale of the island made this really quite straightforward. It's much harder in somewhere like Paris. I suppose as more projects happen, it becomes a little bit easier. But for a lot of people, design is still something that happens on home makeover television programs, or it's the highbrow Milan Design Week approach, where it's just very expensive, sexy artifacts, or it's the likes of Apple just creating products that we interact with. There's a lot of work needed in communicating that we even exist and that there is this version of design which is critical, which is potentially political, which is engaging in the problems that we're facing in the world. We just need to have a little bit more exposure and communicate even our existence. Yeah. And how the approach works and why it's valuable. And, the more projects that happen, the more that process starts to become apparent.
And I think that's what, when you say getting or being political, is in cooperation. Because as often as I see the speculative design products or projects, they are very self-relevant. I don't know the English expression, but they turn around themselves. And
self-important, you might say,
and they are as objects very great, as you say, like wonderfully manufactured artifacts. But the method behind it, as they are crystallizations of an ideation process, the process itself is a bit lost. It's because these objects are very well made and very well thought. You can reimagine that ideation process by watching, or in the best case by handling these objects, but getting them into an interdisciplinary process with people that are very distant from thinking processes based on imagination and fantasy, then it can get that. In that real world implication. While you've been talking, you said the word embedded, and I really like the idea of embed these design strategies into policy governance strategies, in structural development strategies, in education system strategies, in get that coronavirus out of society strategies, like all that stuff. Getting this in and having this kind of embedded imaginations is something that we as designers from a speculative background can bring in, as this is like the cards we have in hand to play in that game, or to contribute, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a tough one, it's many years I've been doing this.
That's true.
It's kind of interesting now, because I've had my 3 years of self-indulgent research, which was wonderful in Madeira, just to really reflect on the state of things. I'm now bringing that back to education myself. I wasn't teaching in Madeira apart from following a couple of PhD candidates. But now at the Ecole Normale Supérieure, we really are just starting to create this Master of Research program where all of these ideas are crystallizing. And with really, I mean, I'm in a lucky position to really think about how do we teach this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the ideal curriculum? Who do we teach with? So as a Master of Research, we're trying to find this very, very, it's a very complex balance between theory and practice. We don't want to drop the practice because this is the real risk. Often when designers get too heavily embedded in academia, they stop designing and just write papers. And so we're really championing and continuing to really express the need for great practice, but practice that's supported by a much more rigorous understanding of the theory that relates to a particular project. So that's what most of my time is spent doing at the moment, is trying to figure out, well, what is this program? So I'm working with Anne Lefebvre, philosopher of technology, and the discussions that we have, well, how can we, if we develop this particular brief, what would be the theoretical knowledge that we would teach alongside the very, very practical design brief? And so trying to come up with an interesting brief that would have related theory that we could teach in the parallel classes. And that theory would then form what the students design. And through that, they start to learn the process. So afterwards, if they do a PhD, for example, they have this ability, which I developed, but for me, it was much, much, much later on. You know, it's typically quite late in an academic career that you really understand the importance of interdisciplinarity or breaking disciplines, of playing with these disciplinary borders. That came to be much later on through working with some excellent people from the social sciences, from the computer sciences, from many different domains. But, you know, it really transformed the way I designed. And, you know, I think it's important. What we're trying to do here is it's important to bring that experience to designers much earlier in their career, much earlier in their training. Because, you know, I think in that way, the work that they do will be, it'll be much more meaningful, and it'll avoid some of the more shallow or the facile ideas that have come out of speculative design over the years that are just sensational for the sake of being sensational.
Yeah, yeah. And I was so happy that you can be just sensational for the sake of being sensational, honestly. I really was glad.
It's nice.
About
yeah. I have to say I do still miss the freedom that brings. Yeah. Being kind of less demanding of ourselves on, you know, what our projects achieve. There is something to be said for the freedom of that, but, you know, it's fine if you acknowledge that is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Don't start claiming it's anything other than that. You know, I think that's the mistake we made. Is
yeah.
We would talk a lot of design for debate and other terms earlier on, and this is where the critique came from in 2012. Is where is the debate? Where is the critical in critical design? You know, this very, very easy criticisms to make that we weren't making ourselves at that point. So, you know, I think it's okay doing provocative, shallow stuff if you know that that's what it is.
Yeah.
If you claim it's not, there's a problem.
Well, we are at 1 hour, James. Basically, that's what we had.
It went fast,
yeah. And we started with that and we ended with that. And it was a very great talk to you. Often, I just make myself notes through these interviews and in the idea of just like doing these things once, because it's so triggering, because more implications than applications, and I really like that. And I thought of the App Store, because it's a store for applications, to think of an imp store where you can have where you can just get implications and that, or impacts, just
about, nice.
Just on demand. And let's
you should register that
Nah, I don't register it. I just give it away. And if somebody wants to do it, I'm very happy. So I don't have to do it. And also, I like the idea of embedded imaginations, like having that thing, that way I'm very in love with myself, great way of thinking that we have as fantastic or fantasyful designers, that we give that to people who do not have that but have other capabilities of gaining impact. And that is embedding our imaginations in, and without manipulating them, just offering them that strange sight that we can contribute to their developments. I think that can be from richness for both sides in the end. As some last words from me, do you have any last words to say?
I guess I'm not going to do the quote justice because I've not got it in front of me. But one of our manifesto points was a quote from Ursula Le Guin, who I think it was something along the lines of, be careful before you put something new into the world. Are you willing to play God or something like that? I can't remember the exact quotation, but you know, when you put things into the world, there is an enormous responsibility. And as designers should ask that question, are we willing to be godlike? Is the power that something like your telephone has over people's lives today? You know, did Apple ask that question in 2007? You know, so there's my leaving statement.
Cool. James, thank you very much. That was the 11th episode of the Hurra Hurra podcast. Here, and see you soon on the number 12 coming up in 2 weeks. Au revoir. Der Design-Podcast der Burg.